7. Just a week or so earlier, during one of their regular private interviews, Logan had finally told Mercedy Ullerton about the great triumph after Ullinor. "You cannot imagine it," he said. "I can try." Logan smiled. The Mechanicum had planed smooth an entire continent as a stage for the event.
Planed smooth? What?
With industrial melters and geoformer engines. Mountains were erased and their matter used to infill valleys. The surface was left smooth and endless, a vast table of dry, polished rock chippings. It took months to accomplish.
It ought to have taken centuries.
You underestimate the industry of the Mechanicum. They sent 4 labor fleets to undertake the work. They made a stage worthy of an emperor, so broad it could know midnight at one end and midday at the other.
You exaggerate, she cried, with a delighted snort.
Maybe I do. Have you known me do that before? Ullerton shook her head. You have to understand, this was a singular event. It was a triumph to mark the turn of an era, and the emperor, beloved of all, knew it. He knew it had to be remembered. It was the end of the Ullinor campaign, the end of the Crusade, the coronation of the Warmaster. It was a chance for the Astartes to say farewell to the Emperor before his departure to Terra, after 2 centuries of personal leadership. We wept as he announced his retirement from the field. Can you picture that, Mercedy? 100,000 warriors weeping. She nodded.
I think it was a shame no remembrances were there to witness it. It was a moment that comes only once every epoch.
It was a private affair.
She laughed again. 100,000 present, a continent levelled for the event, and it was a private affair.
Logan looked at her. Even now you don't understand us, do you? You still think on a very human scale.
I stand corrected, she replied.
I meant no offence, he said, noticing her expression. But it was a private affair. A ceremony. 100,000 Astartes. 8 million army regulars. Legions of Titan war machines, like forests of steel. Armor units by the 100. Formations of tanks, thousands upon thousands. Warships filling the low orbit, eclipsed by the squadrons of aircraft flying over in unending echelons. Banners and standards. So many banners and standards.
He fell silent for a moment, remembering.
The Mechanicum had made a roadway. 0.5 kilometer wide and 500 kilometers long. A straight line across the stage they had levelled. On each side of this road, every 5 meters, was an iron post topped with the skull of a greenskin. Trophies of the Ullinor War. Beyond the roadway, to either hand, promethium fires burned in rock-creek basins. For 500 kilometers. The heat was intense. We marched along the roadway in review, passing below the dais on which the Emperor stood, beneath a steel-scale canopy. The dais was the only raised structure the Mechanicum had left, the root of an old mountain. We marched in review, and then assembled on the wide plain below the dais.
Who marched?
All of us. 14 legions were represented, either in total or by a company. The others were engaged in wars too remote to allow them to attend. The Lunar Wolves were there en masse, of course. 9 Primarchs were there, Mercedy. 9. Horus, Dawn, Angron, Fulgrim, Lorgar, Mortarion, Sanguinius, Magnus, the Khan. The rest had sent ambassadors. Such a spectacle. You cannot imagine.
I'm still trying.
Logan shook his head. I'm still trying to believe I was there.
What were they like?
You think I met them? I was just another brother warrior marching in the file. In my life, lady, I have seen almost all of the Primarchs at one time or another, but mostly from a distance. I've personally spoken to 2 of them. Until my election to the Mournival, I didn't move in such elevated circles. I know the Primarchs as distant figures. At the Triumph, I could barely believe so many were present.
But still, you had impressions.
Indelible impressions. Each one so mighty, so huge, and so proud. They seemed to embody human characteristics. Angron, red and angry. Dawn, solid and implacable. Magnus, veiled in mystery. And Sanguinius, of course, so perfect. So charismatic.
I've heard this of him.
Then you've heard the truth.
His long black hair was pressed down by the weight of the shawl of gold chain he wore across his head. The edges of it framed his solemn features. He had marked his cheeks with grey ash in mourning. An attendant stood by with inkpot and brush to paint the ritual tears of grief on his cheeks. But Primarch Sanguinius shook his head, making the chain shawl clink.
"I have real tears," he said.
He turned not to his brother Horus, but to Torgadon.
"Show me, Tarik," he said.
Torgadon nodded. The wind moaned around the still figures assembled on the lonely hillside, and rain pattered off their armor plate. Torgadon gestured, and Tarvitz, Bull, and Lucius stepped forwards, holding out the dirty relics.
"These men, my lord," Torgadon said, his voice unusually shaky. "These children of the Emperor recovered these remains selflessly, and it is fit they offer them to you themselves."
"You did this honour?" Sanguinius asked Tarvitz.
"I did, my lord."
Sanguinius took the battered Astartes helm from Tarvitz's hands and studied it. He towered over the captain, his golden plate badged with rubies and bright jewels, and marked, like the armour of the War Master, with the unblinking eye of terror. Sanguinius's vast wings, like the pinions of a giant eagle, were furled against his back, and hung with silver bands and loops of pearls. Sanguinius turned the helm over in his hands, and regarded the armourer's mark inside the rim.
"8-night leopard," he said.
At his side, Chapter Master Ralderon began to inspect the manifest.
"Don't trouble yourself, Ral," Sanguinius told him. "I know the mark. Captain Thoros, he will be missed."
Sanguinius handed the helm to Ralderon and nodded to Tarvitz.
"Thank you for this kindness, Captain," he said.
He looked across at Eidolon.
"And to you, sir, my gratitude that you came to Frome's help so urgently."
Eidolon bowed and seemed to ignore the dark glare the War Master was casting in his direction. Sanguinius turned to Torgadon.
"And to you, Tarik, most of all, for breaking this nightmare open."
"I do only what my War Master instructs me," Torgadon replied.
Sanguinius looked over at Horus.
"Is that right?"
"Tarik had some latitude," Horus smiled. He stepped forwards and embraced Sanguinius to his breast. No two Primarchs were as close as the War Master and the Angel. They had barely been out of each other's company since Sanguinius's arrival. The majestic Lord of the Blood Angels, the 9th Legion Astartes, stepped back and looked out across the forlorn landscape. Around the base of the ragged hill, hundreds of armoured figures waited in silence. The vast majority wore either the hard white of the Lunar Wolves or the arterial red of the Angels, save for the remnants of the detachment of Emperor's Children, a small knot of purple and gold. Behind the Astartes, the war machines waited in the rain, silent and black, ringing the gathering like spectral mourners. Beyond them, the hosts of the Imperial Army stood in observance, banners flapping sluggishly in the cold breeze. Their armoured vehicles and troop carriers were drawn up in echelon, and many of the soldiers had clambered up to stand on the hulls to get a better view of the proceedings. Torgadon's spear tip had raised a large sector of the landscape, demolishing stone trees wherever they could be found, and thus taming the formidable weather in this part of Murder. The sky had faded to a mottled powder grey, run through with thin white bars of cloud, and rain fell softly and persistently, reducing visibility in the distances to a foggy blur. At the War Master's command, the main force of the assembled Imperial ships had made planetfall in the comparative safety of the storm-free zone.
"In the old philosophies of Terra," Sanguinius said, "so I have read, vengeance was seen as a weak motive and a flaw of the spirit. It is hard for me to feel so noble today. I would cleanse this rock in the memory of my lost brothers and their kin who died trying to save them."
The Angel looked at his Primarch brother.
"But that is not necessary. Vengeance is not necessary. There is Xenos here, implacable alien menace that rejects any civilized intercourse with mankind, and has greeted us with murder and murder alone. That suffices. As the Emperor, beloved by all, has taught us, since the start of our crusade,
What is anathema to mankind must be dealt with directly to ensure the continued survival of the Imperium. Will you stand with me?
We will murder together, Horus replied.
Once those words were spoken, the Astartes went to war for 6 months. Supported by the army and the devices of the Mechanicum, they assaulted the bleak, shivering latitudes of the world called Murder, and laid waste the Megarachnid. It was a glorious war, in many ways, and not an easy one. No matter how many of them were slaughtered, the Megarachnid did not cower or turn in retreat. It seemed as if they had no will, nor any spirit, to be broken. They came on and on, issuing forth from cracks and crevices in the ruddy land, day after day, set for further dispute. At times, it felt as if there was an endless reserve of them, as if unimaginably vast nests of them infested the mantle of the planet, or as if ceaseless subterranean factories manufactured more and yet more of them every day to replace the losses delivered by the Imperial forces. For their own part, no matter how many of them they slaughtered, the warriors of the Imperium did not come to underestimate the Megarachnid. They were lethal and tough, and so numerous as to put a man out of countenance.
The 50th beast I killed, little Horus remarked at one stage, was as hard to overcome as the first.
Loken, like many of the Lunar Wolves present, personally rejoiced in the circumstances of the conflict, for it was the first time since his election as War Master that the commander had led them on the field. Early on, in the command habitant, one rainy evening, the Mournival had gently tried to dissuade Horus from field operations. Abaddon had attempted, deftly, to portray the War Master's role and importance as a thing of a much higher consequence than martial engagement.
Am I not fit for it?
Horus had scowled, the rain drumming on the canopy overhead.
I mean you are too precious for it, Lord, Abaddon had countered. This is one world, one field of war. The Emperor has charged you with the concerns of all worlds and all fields. Your scope is...
Ezekiel.
The War Master's tone had betrayed a warning note, and he had switched to Chthonic, a clear sign his mind was on war and nothing else.
Do not presume to instruct me on my duties.
Lord, I would not, Abaddon exclaimed immediately, with a respectful bow.
Precious is the word,
Aximan had put in quickly, coming to Abaddon's aid.
If you were to be wounded, to fall even, it would...
Horus rose, glaring.
Now you deride my abilities as a warrior, little one. Have you grown soft since my ascendance?
No, my lord, no.
Only Torgadon, it seemed, had noticed the glimmer of amusement behind the War Master's pantomime of anger.
We're only afraid you won't leave any glory for us, he said.
Horus began to laugh. Realizing he had been playing with them, the members of the Mournival began to laugh too. Horus cuffed Abaddon across the shoulder and pinched Aximan's cheek.
We'll war this together, my sons, he said. That is how I was made. If I had suspected back at Ulanor that the rank of War Master would require me to relinquish the glories of the field forever, I would not have accepted it. Someone else could have taken the honor. Gilliman, or the Lion, perhaps. They ache for it, after all.
More loud amusement followed. The laughter of Chthonians is dark and hard, but the laughter of Lunar Wolves is a harder thing altogether. Afterwards, Loken wondered if the War Master had not been using his sly political skills yet again. He had avoided the central issue entirely, and deflected their concerns with good humor and an appeal to their code as warriors. It was his way of telling them that, for all their good counsel, there were some matters on which his mind would not be swayed. Loken was sure that Sanguinius was the reason. Horus could not bring himself to stand by and watch his dearest brother go to war. Horus could not resist the temptation of fighting shoulder to shoulder with Sanguinius, as they had done in the old days. Horus would not let himself be outshone, even by the one he loved most dearly. To see them together on the battlefield was a heart-stopping thing. Two gods of war, raging at the head of a tide of red and white. Dozens of times they accomplished victories in partnership on murder that should, had what followed been any different, become deeds as lauded and immortal as Ulanor or any other great triumph. Indeed, the war as a whole produced many extraordinary feats that posterity ought to have celebrated, especially now the remembrances were amongst them.
Like all her kind, Mercedes Ollerton was not permitted to descend to the surface with the fighting echelons. But she absorbed every detail transmitted back from the surface. The daily ebb and flow of the brutal warfare, the losses and the gains. When, periodically, Loken returned with his company to the flagship to rest, repair, and rearm, she quizzed him furiously, and made him describe all he had seen. Horus and Sanguinius side by side was what interested her the most, but she was captivated by all his accounts. Many battles had been vast, pitched affairs, where thousands of Astartes led tens of thousands of army troopers against endless files of the Megarachnid. Loken struggled to find the language to describe it, and sometimes felt himself, foolishly, borrowing lurid turns of phrase he had picked up from the Chronicles of Ursh. He told her of the great things he had witnessed, the particular moments. How Luke Sedere had led his company against a formation of Megarachnid 25 deep and 100 across, and splintered it in under half an hour. How Sacrus Carminus, captain of the Blood Angels, 3rd Company, had held the line against a buzzing host of winged clades through one long, hideous afternoon. How Yactan Cruz, despite his stubborn, tiresome ways, had broken the back of a surprise Megarachnid assault and proved there was metal in him still. How Tybalt Mar, the Either, had taken the low mountains in 2 days and elevated himself at last into the ranks of the exceptional. How the Megarachnid had revealed more and yet more nightmarish biological variations, including massive clades that strode forwards like armored war machines, and how the titans of the Mechanicum, led at the van by the Deus Irae of the Legio Mortis, smote them apart and trampled their blackened wing cases underfoot. How Saul Tarvitz, fighting at Torgadon's side rather than in the cohort of his arrogant Lord Eidolon, renewed the Lunar Wolf's respect for the Emperor's children through several feats of arms. Tarvitz and Torgadon had achieved a brotherhood during the war and eased the discontent between the two legions. Loken had heard rumors that Eidolon was initially displeased with Tarvitz's deportment, until he recognized how simple brotherhood and effort was redeeming his mistake. Eidolon, though he would never admit it, realized full well he was out of favor with the Warmaster, but, as time passed, he found he was at least tolerated within the bounds of the commander's war tent, and consulted along with the other officers. Sanguinius had also smoothed the way. He knew his brother Horus was keen to rebuke Fulgrim for the high-handed qualities his Astartes had lately displayed. Horus and Fulgrim were close, almost as close as Sanguinius and the Warmaster. It dismayed the Lord of Angels to see a potential rift in the making. "You cannot afford dissent," Sanguinius had said. "As Warmaster, you must have the undivided respect of the Primarchs, just as the Emperor had. Moreover, you and Fulgrim are too long bound as brothers for you to fall to bickering." The conversation had taken place during a brief hiatus in the fighting, during the 6th week, when Raldoron and Sedere were leading the main force west into a series of valleys and narrow defiles along the foothills of a great bank of mountains. The two Primarchs had rested for a day in a command camp some leagues behind the advance. Loken remembered it well. He and the others of the Mournival had been present in the main war tent when Sanguinius brought the matter up. "I don't bicker," Horus said, as his armourers removed his heavy, mud-flecked war gear and bathed his limbs. "The Emperor's children have always been proud, but that pride is becoming insolence. Brother or not, Fulgrim must know his place. I have trouble enough with Angron's bloody rages and Perturabo's damn petulance. I'll not brook disrespect from such a close ally." "Was it Fulgrim's error, or his man Eidolon's?" Sanguinius asked. "Fulgrim made Eidolon Lord Commander. He favours his merits, and evidently trusts him, and approves of his manner. If Eidolon embodies the character of the 3rd Legion, then I have issue with it. Not just here. I need to know I can rely upon the Emperor's children." "And why do you think you can't?" Horus paused while an attendant washed his face, then spat sidelong into a bowl held ready by another. "Because they're too damn proud of themselves." "Are not all the Astartes proud of their own cohort?" Sanguinius took a sip of wine. He looked over at the Mournival. "Are you not proud, Ezekiel?" "To the ends of creation, my lord," Abaddon replied.
"If I may, sir," said Torgadon. "There is a difference. There is a man's natural pride and loyalty to his own legion,
That may be a boastful pride, and the source of rivalry between Astartes, but the Emperor's children seem particularly haughty, as if above the likes of us. Not all of them, I hasten to add. Listening, Loken knew Torgadon was referring to Tarvitz and the other friends he had made among Tarvitz's unit. Sanguinius nodded.
It is their mindset. It has always been so. They seek perfection, to be the best they can, to echo the perfection of the Emperor himself. It is not superiority. Fulgrim has explained this to me himself.
And Fulgrim may believe so, Horace said. But superiority is how it manifests amongst some of his men. There was once mutual respect, but now they sneer and condescend. I fear it is my new rank that they resent. I'll not have it.
They don't resent you, Sanguinius said.
Maybe. But they resent the role my rank invests upon my legion. The Lunar Wolves have always been seen as rude barbarians. The flint of Chthonia is in their hearts, and the smudge of its dirt upon their skins. The children regard the Lunar Wolves as peers only by dint of my legion's record in war. The wolves sport no finery or elegant manners. We are cheerfully raw where they are regal.
Then maybe it is time to consider doing what the Emperor suggested, Sanguinius said.
Horace shook his head emphatically.
I refused that on Ulanor, honor though it was. I'll not contemplate it again. Things change. You are War Master now. All the legions Astartes must recognize the preeminence of the 16th Legion. Perhaps some need to be reminded.
Horace snorted.
I don't see Rus trying to clean up his berserk horde and rebrand them to court respect. Leman Russ is not War Master, said Sanguinius. Your title changed, brother, at the Emperor's command, so that all the rest of us would be in no mistake as to the power you wield and the trust the Emperor placed in you.
Perhaps the same thing must happen to your legion. Later, as they trudged west through the drizzle, following the plodding Titans across red mudflats and skeins of surface water, Loken asked Abaddon what the Lord of Angels had meant.
At Ulanor, the first captain answered, the beloved Emperor advised our commander to rename the 16th Legion, so there might be no mistake as to the power of our authority.
What name did he wish us to take? Loken asked.
The Sons of Horus, Abaddon replied.
The sixth month of the campaign was drawing to a close when the strangers arrived. Over the period of a few days, the vessels of the expedition, high in orbit, became aware of curious signals and etheric displacements that suggested the activity of starships nearby, and various attempts were made to locate the source. Advised of the situation, the War Master presumed that other reinforcements were on the verge of arrival, perhaps even additional units from the Emperor's children. Patrolling scout ships, sent out by Master Comnemnus, and cruisers on picket control, could find no concrete trace of any vessels, but many reported spectral readings, like the precursor field elevations that announced an imminent translation. The expedition fleet left high anchor and took station on a battle-ready grid, with the vengeful spirit and the proud heart in the vanguard, and the misery cord and the red tear, Sanguinius's flagship, on the trailing flank. When the strangers finally appeared, they came in rapidly and confidently, gunning in from a translation point at the system edges. Three massive capital ships, of a build pattern and drive signature unknown to Imperial records. As they came closer, they began to broadcast what seemed to be challenge signals. The nature of these signals was remarkably similar to the repeat of the outstation beacons, untranslatable and, according to the War Master, akin to music. The ships were big. Visual relay showed them to be bright, sleek, and silver-white, shaped like royal scepters, with heavy prows, long, lean hulls, and splayed drive sections. The largest of them was twice the keel length of the Vengeful Spirit. General alert was sounded throughout the fleet, shields raised and weapons unshrouded. The War Master made immediate preparations to quit the surface and return to his flagship. Engagements with the Megarachnid were hastily broken off, and the ground forces recalled into a single host. Horus ordered Comnemnus to make hail and hold fire unless fired upon. There seemed a high probability that these vessels belonged to the Megarachnid, come from other worlds in support of the nests on Murder. The ships did not respond directly to the hails, but continued to broadcast their own curious signals. They prowled in close and halted within firing distance of the expedition formation. Then they spoke. Not with one voice, but with a chorus of voices, uttering the same words, overlaid with more of the curious musical transmissions. The message was received cleanly by the Imperial Vox, and also by the astro-telepaths. Conveyed with such force and authority, Ing Mei Sing and her adepts winced. They spoke in the language of mankind. "Did you not see the warnings we left?" they said. "What have you done here?"